Good morning. Welcome back to the program. How many of you think about what you wanted to be as a child? At a time when the world was filled with possibility, when your parents told you you could do or be anything, when you would sit with your friends for hours talking about what kind of life you were going to have. Sometimes those useful ambitions come to define us for the rest of our lives, both in terms of what we achieve and what we don't achieve. I knew a woman once who was a world-renowned ballerina with the Joffrey Ballet. I once asked her how she achieved that. She said she just did what every little girl does. She dressed up, got her mom to take her to ballet classes, except that she never stopped. How much of her success was family, luck, talent? Who knows? These are just some of the ideas inside Meg Wolitzer's sweeping new novel, The Interestings, the story of six teenagers coming of age in the 70s and the 40 years that would follow. Meg Wolitzer is the author of The Wife, The 10-Year Nap, and The Uncoupling. It is my pleasure to welcome her here to talk about her newest work, The Interestings. Meg Wolitzer, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Delighted to have you here. It seems like the world is divided into two groups, those that went to sleepaway camp and remember it, and those that didn't have the opportunity.
Yeah, it seems that way, too. I mean, I recently did a book talk, and I said to the room, how many of you went to summer camp? And, you know, I'd say a half to a third raised their hand. This is about 800 people. And then I realized that, you know, the book is not just about summer camp because it follows over 40 years. So I said, well, how many of you are getting older? And then the rest of the room raised their hand. So, I think the idea of summer camp, what I mean by that here is, you know, you obviously don't have to have gone to summer camp to understand what I'm talking about. It's about that moment. It starts at that moment when you're with your friends and your parents aren't there and there's a sort of spark of life, and you start to kind of come alive for the first time in a new way. And that can happen at summer camp. It can happen off with friends on a, you know, away somewhere. It can happen at someone's house. It just happens when you're a teenager and you're starting to sort of realize what the world can hold.
There's something about the camp, though, I guess, that provides, certainly it does for this particular group of kids, for the Interestings, a kind of bonding experience, being away, being sort of on their own at that age.
Yeah, I mean, I had that experience myself. When I was 15, I was sent by my parents to a summer camp in Massachusetts. And it was very similar to the kind of camp in The Interestings. It was an arts camp for arty teenagers, and I did a lot of acting there. And I loved it so much, and the beauty of the surroundings, and the sort of smells, and the food, and the dining hall, and the theater, all of that was thrilling to me. But the most thrilling thing of all was the people I met, and I think that that's what really it's all about.
Talk about that, and the bonding of this group of six kids, and the fact that it is so strong and so powerful, it does carry them through their life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a group that's similar to that. And even when you talk about a group over time, you're really talking about sort of people drift in and out of one another's lives. It's hard to maintain that. They don't tell you that when you're a kid, that when you grow up, your friends will not all be in one constant cluster, that you may want a family, that you may move, that you're free to kind of live your life. And there's some sadness associated with that. But in this novel, the bond is incredibly strong, and my main character, Jules, just sort of falls in love with this group of kids. She finds them so talented. She's from the suburbs. They're from New York City. They are more sophisticated than she is. They know more than she does, and she just loves them and wants to be with them forever, and in a lot of ways, she really does do that.
The other aspect is that it is about this sense of limitless possibility that these kids have. I mean, in many ways, it's part of youth in general. These kids, particularly the ones from the city, because they're somewhat privileged, have this sense that anything is possible in their lives.
Yeah, they really do. And I think that that's something that, you know, you mentioned earlier about talent and luck and things like that. So much of what happens with talent is luck and circumstance and class and money and connections. And the endless possibilities is something that if you grow up with parents who say you can do anything and who aren't worried about you, maybe you feel that you really can do anything, and maybe you will have a certain kind of cushion that allows you to do things. Because I've seen people who are so, so talented end up kind of curtailing their talents because they know that they have to survive financially and they don't have anything to fall back on, and they end up taking a different kind of job and using their art when they can, in the spare time between things. And it's very, very hard to make it in the arts in this country, regardless of who you are. But one of the kids in the book, Ethan Figman, who becomes an animator and becomes, you know, brilliantly famous and rich beyond anyone's imaginings, he does so in some part because of his connections.
What was it about that particular time in the mid-70s that was different than today in terms of the way that these kids approach the world, do you think?
Well, one thing is, I think that back then, if I think about my life, we weren't hovered over by parents in the same way that I think kids today are. There's this kind of anxiety with parents that goes on now and a sort of involvement in their kids' lives. There's something to be said for the freedom that we were given when I was a teenager in the 70s. You know, we went off for long periods of time. Our parents didn't know where we were or what we were doing. And in those moments, you really can, you know, if you're not screwing up and if you're not doing something stupid, you really can come up with some great ideas.
And that really is, in many ways, parents think that they're helping their kids, but in many ways they're holding them back today by being such helicopter parents.
Yeah, I mean, I know that I'm sure I'm guilty of it myself with my kids, but you want to sort of feel that your kids are safe. That's the primary thing, and yet you want them to soar. And yet soaring and safety don't seem to really go together. So how do you justify that? You can't. You absolutely can't.
It also seemed, that period also seemed to be the beginning of this idea that we needed to tell our kids that A, anything was possible, and that B, how talented and how wonderful and how terrific they were, this sense of building up their self-esteem.
Yeah, self-esteem has really become, overused as a concept in this country. The idea that everyone is great at everything, that nobody is just sort of regular or average or even below average, is absurd. And, I think that it was well-intentioned, that sort of move toward self-esteem. The fear is that, you know, you'll have a depressed kid who will feel, I can't do anything. But back when I was a teenager and we didn't have parents saying that all the time, it happened anyway that talented kids just sort of sought out what they love to do. I mean, I put something in my novel that happened to me in real life. I gave a reading and a woman said to me that her daughter wanted to be a playwright or a director, I don't remember which, and she was so concerned, the mother, because she knew how few slots there were in the world for a playwright or a director, and what should she tell her daughter? And I thought about it for a second, and I said that I thought she should tell her daughter that was wonderful, because the world would whittle her daughter down probably, but a mother never should.
Part of it is the difference between how much of that ambition and that desire comes from an inner flame that kids may have versus what they're trying to do because they don't want to disappoint their parents.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're doing something to not disappoint your parents, you are just sort of a prisoner of your parents, and it's not going to get you anywhere in a real way. And it's not going to make you feel good. And why do art? Why, or anything, really? It's not just about doing art, but why do anything if it's for someone else? You know, when you start writing, actually, I think that a lot of people do start writing for someone else, whether it's a parent or a teacher or even like a fantasy of Jane Austen's ghost. And that can get you very, very far, the idea of sort of writing to please someone. But the next step is really giving it up. And I think that that's the point at which artists go to the next level.
There's also this sense of fantasy about the lives these kids think they're going to have. When they're that young, they all imagine their lives unfolding before them in a kind of glamorous way, and that doesn't always work out that way.
No, it usually doesn't work out that way. I mean, if our lives were linear, everything would be a lot easier to sort of imagine how things are going to go. But when we were young, and if there was a kid at camp, as there were quite a few, who was so great, who was like so great at what they did, we thought, oh, they're going to become famous. I mean, that's what a child thinks. Oh, she's such a great actress. She's definitely going to make it. But then, of course, the world, narrows down. It's like you're pushed through a funnel, and there are less possibilities as you get older. There are fewer possibilities. So it doesn't turn out that way, and that's a great disappointment when you start out thinking anything is possible.
Is that worse today, do you think, because glamour and kind of success porn is so much a part of the culture today, a bigger part than it was even in the mid-70s?
Yeah, I think the idea of being famous is really, really different from the idea of achieving what you want to do in a field. I mean, is it okay to be talented but not have big product? Do you have to always use your talent in a way that's very, very direct? What if you're a wonderful, talented actor when you're young and you become a doctor when you're older, and the compassion that you felt learning about studying characters when you were young is somehow used in how you deal with your patients? Is it a disappointment that you didn't do that initial thing? I mean, obviously, I think the answer is no. I think that we have this great emphasis on success and fame and product, when in fact, what's the point? What's the point of our lives? We're not just little robots who are meant to produce. I mean, you have to feel gratified. You have to feel that you're doing something meaningful.
But even Jules, in The Interestings, feels disappointed, feels kind of envious of those that have had a more glamorous life.
Oh, yeah. She is not she's not a perfect character. I think, you know, envy is talent and envy are the two things that I explored primarily in The Interestings. And with regard to envy, I wanted to write not about that kind of envy that you might sort of see explored in a very open, brash way in a film, but I wanted to talk about the sort of quiet envy that you might feel even for people you love, the kind of depressing envy that you're embarrassed about. You know, is that one's kid smarter than mine? Is her house a little bit nicer? Is the book she wrote a little bit better? And you want your friend to succeed, and yet you feel bad about yourself. I mean, with Jules, her closest friends succeed in a way that she and her husband, who are, you know, really, really hardworking, she becomes a social worker, not an actress, as she always hoped to. She marries an ultrasound technician, not somebody who's rich. But she sees her two closest friends achieve their dreams. And what I realized talking to my editor when I was writing the book is that if she'd never met her friends, she would feel her life was good enough. But the fact that she's met them, she can never quite feel that her life measures up.
And how does she go through life with that sense and not have it bring her down all the time, not have it be debilitating at certain points?
Well, the truth is that she loves her friends and that she actually likes her life a lot, too. But it's very, very hard to sort of be aware of that and to stay on your own path and not look over anxiously toward the left or right. And she's always sort of doing that, but she kind of has to learn not to. And it's a sort of, you know, it's a long path for her, and I wanted to sort of chart talent and envy over time and see how it changes, when you sort of settle into middle age. I mean, the novel starts off being about adolescence and moves into middle age very much, but has the luxury of going back and forth in time between adolescence and middle age.
One of the other things, and we touched on this a little bit before, is the role that luck plays in all of this. And there is an element of that that you've incorporated into The Interestings. Talk about that.
Well, it really is lucky if you happen to live in a family where people have connections and have money and say to you, you know what, you can take a year off after college to just go paint and live in Europe. Most people don't have that luxury. It's incredibly lucky. Also, you meet somebody at a dinner party because you are a sort of connected person, and they say, I want to see your film. I want to see your novel. These are things that most people who are artistic and talented don't have. They're off in different places. They don't know exactly what they're supposed to do. I was at a reading recently, and a guy came up to me afterwards and said, "Are you a writer?" I mean, he knew that writers were there, and he kind of just blurted out, "I want to write. I don't know what to do." He really didn't have a connection to this world. He wasn't separated by 6 degrees of separation from famous writers. And what are you going to do? But the people in this novel, some of them have amazing connections and amazing luck. And Jules sees how much that really comes to play. And she never understood this when she was a teenager.
And it's interesting. She's the kid that was from the suburbs versus all the other friends who were from the city.
Yeah. I mean, I really use that. I mean, you don't obviously, you know, using New York City as a model, it stands for the sort of locus of power and connections, but it really could be a lot of different places. But yeah, she always felt she was a little bit outside, and they are insiders.
Does she question often whether or not she had the talent, whether if she was lucky or if she had the right connections, she might have succeeded in turning her talent into something?
She doesn't question it enough. I mean, you know, she wasn't a great actor when she started doing acting at this camp. She sort of, I imagined her as being kind of the way I was, just sort of being able to project but not really being able to embody. And that's the difference. You know, the ones who were really, really good had something that you could not fake. You couldn't fake it. But she loved being in that world so much that she thought she had to be talented. And when she got to New York City, I mean, there's a little bit of Marjorie Morningstar in the novel, the sort of trying to make it as an actress in New York City. She didn't really have it. She faced rejection all the time. And she saw that maybe what she had was desire more than talent. And a desire is like to live a life of excitement and art and being among talented people. That's very, very different from actually being able to make it yourself and make a living as an artist.
And that's one of the fundamental differences, the degree to which it's about the work versus the degree to which it's about the lifestyle, I suppose.
Yeah, they're very, very different things. I mean, Ethan Figman is really my pure, you know, creative genius character. I kind of wanted to look at different degrees of talent. You can have a talent that's, you know, that you might think of as less major, but helped along by connections and can become something bigger with the collaboration of other people. You might have this pure talent that I think he has that sort of springs out of nowhere and you can't give it to somebody. Or you might have a talent that goes off in another direction and is used for something entirely different. I think there are a variety of talents, and we see them in a very, very narrow way, and we judge ourselves very harshly against other people.
In the modern era, we, of course, quantify it as 10,000 hours being the defining metric.
Yeah. Well, that is true, and you can certainly get to a certain, you know, to a certain level by the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000-hour idea, and yet you can't get to that other level. You can't. I don't know that you can get to the level that I'm describing Ethan as being at, which is something singular, something that you're, you know, that is in you, and that you need to add the 10,000 hours to. But it is in you. There, it is in you. It's who you are.
The other aspect that seems to be somewhat, I suppose, indigenous to the era is the way in which these kids stay connected. It seems that today, because the world is larger, the world that kids have access to is larger, it's harder to stay connected to friends that you had from adolescence.
Well, it's harder and it's easier because they have these means of connection through the Internet. Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't have that at all. I didn't know what happened to some of these kids over all the years. Mm-hmm. I wondered. I sort of pined for some of them, and if they weren't in the directory of New York City, I didn't, you know, the white pages, I didn't know how to find them. They were gone. They were just gone. And then the Internet comes along, and then you look up these people, and you say, oh, my God, here's this one who was this wonderful actor. Oh, and look, she's an emergency room physician now. That's interesting. And I think that, you know, yes, there are more possibilities, but there is more of a sense of being able to stay connected to today.
Meg Wolitzer, her new novel is The Interestings. Meg, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.